Good morning and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast. Today's topic is how to resolve defects in minutes instead of weeks. And today's eCast is presented by the nice folks at Wind River Systems. The speaker today is going to be Jakob Engblom, who is from Wind River Systems, just as you might expect. And he's the he's the senior technical marketing manager in charge of tools and lifecycle solutions there at Wind River Systems. He comes to us all the way from Sweden. We'll hear more from Jakob in just a minute. My name is Jim Turley. I'll be your moderator for today. Everybody say hi, Jim. Thanks very much. Hi back. Before we get started and we let Jakob talk, I've got a little housekeeping information. For those of you who are new to our software, it's pretty easy, but I'll walk you through it anyway. Here's a couple of basics. The whole show is going to take us about an hour from now till an hour from now, and the last 10, maybe 15 minutes of that is going to be question and answer period, where I'll be asking your questions of Jakob so he can answer them for you. Where do the questions come from? Well, that brings us to our next point. You get to type in the questions at any time during the presentation. That's right. You don't have to wait till the end. You can start typing questions right now. How do you do that? You type them into the little box in the lower left corner of your screen. You see the box in the lower left that says Ask a Question? Go ahead and type your question there. Make sure you click the blue Submit Question button afterwards. That'll pop up on my monitor, and I'll be reading that to Jakob at the end of the show. Again, don't forget to do that during the presentation as questions pop into your head. What else can you do? You want to make the slides bigger? We've got a button for that. Down towards the bottom of your screen, there's a blue button that says Enlarge Slides. And guess what? That enlarges the slides. Right next to that, there's another blue button that says Download Slides. That allows you to keep a copy offline for yourself. By the way, speaking of offline copies, this entire presentation, slides, audio, and all, is going to be archived so that you can keep a copy under your pillow for later reference. We're also available on iTunes, and we'll be giving you the iTunes link toward the end of the show so you can find that again. Finally, one more blue button. We've got one called Forward to a Friend, which does pretty much what you'd expect. That allows you to send the whole presentation to a colleague, relative, or family member for their reference as well. Well, that pretty much takes care of the software run-through. That's pretty basic stuff. So with that, we're going to turn the presentation over to Jakob Engblom at Wind River System, and he's going to tell us how to resolve defects in minutes instead of weeks. Take it away, Jakob.
Thank you, Jim. I hope everybody can hear me. Well, with no notes, I assume that's the case. So this is about how you resolve defects faster, and in particular, how we fix system-level issues with a system-level debugger. My agenda is I'm going to start by introducing system-level debug some, then I'm going to talk about Wind River Simics, my favorite tool. After that, it's going to be a bit about system-level debugging with Simics, two recorded demos, a short note about the Simics Quick Start platform, and after that, I'm going to go to questions and answers. So, debugging, everybody's favorite topic, right? And debug is funny. I mean, it's one of these things that have always been with us as we've been developing computers. There's a quote which could be taken from today, essentially. The complaint is that, you know, if you just wrote your software right, there would be no need to debug. But it seems that we just cannot get away from actually trying things and debugging them. And this was actually written before there was such a thing as debugging. This paper was published in 1951, and it was written around 1950, documenting stuff that went on in 1949 in the Cambridge Computer Lab. So basically, only a few years after the end of World War II, we had realized that we have to be able to interactively debug our computer program. And the Dr. Jill, who wrote this paper, basically wrote the world's first interactive single-stepping debugger. And today, I mean, more than 60 years later, we're still doing debugging because there's still no end in sight to the fact that, you know, we have to debug our programs. Once programs hit reality, new things happen which we cannot predict. So we need to debug them in a live system. And the classic debugger we're all familiar with is basically what I tend to call me and my program. So I have a debugger, I have a target program, and that target program essentially has a single thread of control, and my debugger has a single locus of control following that target program, you know, stepping forward, jumping forward, looking at variables. And this is all nice and dandy, but it's kind of starting to fall apart today. So one thing that's happened is that people have moved to multi-core and multi-threaded debuggers, where the debuggers work with a target program, but you can also have multiple threads within that target program. This, you know, is really nice when you have a multi-threaded or multi-core parallel system. But it doesn't end there, because even as you look at the target program with multiple threads, well, that thing is actually interacting with an operating system. And once you're in an operating system, well, you might well have other target programs as well. And quite often, you're actually interested in how a couple of these programs interact with each other. I mean, it's pretty rare these days to see a system that only contains a single program. You tend to have plenty of stuff going on in parallel. And speaking of parallel, systems can go way beyond just a single operating system, right? I mean, you can have multiple operating system instances, like if you have multiple boards, or you're using a hypervisor and multiple guest operating system or something like that. It's very, very common to have a system containing multiple operating systems, multiple programs inside each OS instance, and multiple threads inside each target program. And basically, at some level, this whole mess is what we have to debug. And that's system-level debugging. And why do we get this? Well, it seems that multi has become a very popular word in recent times. Inside of programs, we have multiple threads. Inside an operating system, we have multiple processes or multiple programs. As I said before, we have multiple operating systems. The move towards hypervisors and partition systems means we have even more operating systems to contend with. And on the hardware side, we have multi-core hardware. We have multiple multi-core chips on a single board. We have multiple architectures being used, like, you know, control architectures and DSPs and accelerators and different size processors. And we have heterogeneous architectures. It's very, very common that if you look closely at a real system, it contains two or three different processor architectures, because you have some main processors, you have some side processors, some helper processors, some board controllers. I mean, the world is incredibly heterogeneous today. And this really brings us to system-level debug, because debuggers pretty much have to scale up to follow along the software and system complexity. So it's not enough anymore to have a debugger just looking at a single program. We need a debugger that can actually attach to a system and debug at the system level. We at Wind River have been working on system-level tools and system-level debuggers for a few years now, and I think we're making pretty good progress. I'm going to talk more about what we're doing later in this presentation, obviously. But before we do that, I need to point out one very important fact. Application-level debug, you know, this classic debug, me and my program, it's still there. That is the base case for all debugging. I mean, you cannot just debug at a very high level. In the end, you have to go down, look at the code, and step to that single line of code or that, you know, single assignment to a variable that actually was wrong, that actually broke your program in some way. So system-level debug is application-level debug applied to many things at once. So, what is Simex? Simex is a full system simulation solution. And what this means is that we look at some piece of computing hardware used in the real world to run software as part of some typically embedded system. Could also be, you know, a server or a general purpose system, but most of our customers are in the embedded space. And we take that hardware. We build a software model or virtual platform out of it. So now we have a software program inside of Simex, which behaves the same as the real hardware. And on top of this software fiction, so to speak, we run the actual real software stack from the target system. And now that we have our software inside the simulation system, we can start to do some pretty interesting things to it. So, first of all, Simex can do things like checkpoint and restore. And this means that we take the state of the entire target system, we save it to disk, and we bring it up again later. So this enables you to essentially save the state of your work, even when you're working with some, you know, really gnarly little embedded board. We can simulate these multi-X systems, you know, multiple processors, multiple architectures, multiple operating systems, multiple hypervisors, multiple networks, systems of systems. Simics can actually usefully simulate all of these things in a single simulation run at the same time and debug the whole thing as a whole. A pretty unique feature of Simics is reverse execution and reverse debugging. So this means we can actually run the system in reverse, and we can put breakpoints or watch points and go back in time and see just what happened before the current point in time. And that has a truly profound effect on how you do debugging and the efficiency of debugging. Another example of what you can do with a simulator is very precise, completely repeatable fault injection, which is also, by the way, non-destructive because we're only affecting a simulation model, not just, you know, the not something real. We're not taking an axe to a rack here. We're taking a virtual axe to a virtual rack, and it's very easy to restore the state before the fault happened. And this is actually a very important aspect of, you know, simulation use. We can force corner cases, fault conditions, you know, extreme configurations in order to test the software under all circumstances. We also have very nice control and insight into the target. And this means that we can, for example, write scripts in Simics which watch what's going on in the target and provide inputs and really drive the target system completely automatically with completely repeatable timing to where we want it to be. And we can look at traces of pretty much anything going on inside the target, you know, device registers, interrupts, network packets, memory accesses, whatever. Everything is available for trace with Simics. And what this means for a software or system development project is essentially that it runs better. That's our experience. And the main theme we see when we talk to customers about this is that we tend to shift schedules left. And we do that for a number of different reasons. First of all, the obvious one is that we can use a hardware model which can be available before the actual hardware to develop the software. So we can parallelize hardware and software development. But what we can also do is to actually push integration left, since in a simulation, it's very easy to stub out some part of the system which you're not interested in right now or which isn't ready yet, but still integrate the other parts. It's much, much easier to kind of work with subsets of your system, both subsets of hardware and software. And this kind of gives us an interesting model where we have an agile development cycle going from hardware model to software development to system integration and back again, often way before the hardware is even available. We also see that with a virtual platform, we reduce the risk of development, which is a very, you know, managerial thing to say, but in practice, that means that, for example, if you are dependent on some hardware board appearing at some point in time in order to actually demonstrate your software stack to some external stakeholder, if that hardware is delayed, your demo is going to be delayed, and you know your project and you might also be delayed. What we can do in a virtual platform is to say, look, if you build a virtual platform with this hardware, we absolutely know that we are going to have something to run on. So even if the hardware gets delayed, the software project can proceed. So this way we can decouple development efforts. We also allow interdependencies between teams to be kind of, you know, loosened up a bit because, once again, with the simulator, we can stub things out, we can kind of, you know, approximate and build in dummies to make it possible to kind of do things in parallel that otherwise would be serialized due to the fact that A needs to happen before B. In this case, you might have both happen at the same time using an early version, and then later on kind of fill in the details and continue working. So it kind of provides, it kind of lets you use modern agile development methods, not just on the high-level software, but also on operating systems, low-level software, and the system integration. Because now, in a way, I mean, your hardware is just software, and you can do really interesting things given that fact. You can also manage large systems. I mean, one of the fun parts about developing a, you know, semi-complex system is the fact that usually you have to go scrounge for parts, find the right boards, find the right, you know, boxes, wire them up in the right way, and then you might be able to do something. With a simulator, that, you know, collecting of the parts and wiring them up is just a script. I mean, instead of spending hours or days, you know, configuring the lab, all you have to do is to run a script that just sets up the right boxes, connect them in the right way, and boom, you're ready to go. And you know you have the same configuration as the person who wrote it, so you have a very strong feeling that you're working on the same setup as the other guys are. And that also helps move in development, because you're not running around looking for little glitches or did you make a mistake in the setup. You know the setup, you can script the setup, you can give it to other people with perfect reliability. And the final thing we see is that SimSimix is such a nice debug and insight and control environment. Resolving showstopper bugs tends to be much, much easier with SimSimix than using hardware. And these are the bugs, you know, that take, you know, 4 expert engineers, 6 months of, you know, full time to resolve. Often these can be resolved in a fraction of the time using a virtual platform in SimSimix in particular, because we're able to capture the bug and diagnose it so much more efficiently than if you have to do 1,000 runs on a complex real-world system to, you know, make a bug happen once. So let's move on to how we do system-level debug with SimSimix. First of all, what we have here is a mixed architecture debugger. So even if you have a system consisting of, you know, 32-bit ARM little engine machines, you know, 32-bit big engine power PC machines, and 64-bit little engine Intel architecture machines, you can actually debug all of them at once from the same debugger UI. This is actually incredibly convenient, because today the dominant model is that each and every operating system, each and every target architecture has its own separate debugger. But our vision is to have a single debugger which covers all the architectures at once within a single window. And another part of that is the fact that we have a single connection to the target system. So our debugger uses a single TCF, Target Connection Framework connection, to the target system. And that's used to manage all the target parts. It's used to do all runtime control. Usually, once again, if you have a heterogeneous system today, you tend to have one different debug connection to each target, or even one different debug connection to each target core. And that becomes completely unmanageable very, very quickly. With SimSimix, we can have, you know, 100 machines inside a single simulation and use a single debug connection to control it all. And still, you know, it's a single window to debug the entire target system. This really makes for a very different kind of debugger architecture. And right now, I mean, the TCF framework, that's an open source standard. Everybody's free to use it. We have donated all the source code into open source into Eclipse. And everybody who's building a system-level tool that in some way talks to a moderately complex target system should have a long, hard look at TCF, because I think that is the best standard there is to actually talk to something complex. Another thing we get in a system-level debugger is the ability to debug across the software stack. And we can do that both horizontally and vertically. First of all, we have the same debugger being used to debug an hypervisor, an operating system, target applications. I mean, there's no difference. Today, often you have to kind of change debugger as you move up and down the stack. With this solution, you have the same debugger regardless whether you're, you know, debugging some early firmware, debugging a driver, debugging an operating system, or just, you know, doing regular user-level debug. I mean, it's the same debug solution. And we have a single debug session across all these levels. So within a single connection to the target, I'm actually covering all the layers of the software stack on that target. We have OS awareness in the simulator, so we're actually able to figure out what the current software state is, like, you know, watching which processes are executing when and actually operate on that. And what you can do is you can follow execution, you know, up and down the software stack. I mean, you can see, okay, this application is doing a system call, let's follow that system call into the kernel and, you know, follow it all the way down to the hardware and back up again. Or you can follow the execution horizontally, saying that let's just debug within this application. I am not interested in the rest of the system, and let's just, you know, move forward until the next time my application is active on OS or the next time a breakpoint hits in my application. So you can debug across all the layers and through a single layer ignoring the other layers. And this is a very, very powerful ability to have in the debugger. As said before, we have reverse debugging and repeatability. And this is really a very key part of the value point of CEMEX. If you're working on hardware, typically this is what happens. You discover a bug, and then you try to debug it, you try to rerun the same scenario, and more often than not, you don't hit the same bug because the bug depends on some subtle timing or some particular practice of the some particular property of the input to your target system. In a simulator, we can capture all the asynchronous inputs so we can repeat the run trivially. So once you've gotten the error in the simulator, you've got it. You can repeat it any number of times. And also, once you have it in the simulator, you're able to reverse out of the faulty situation and go back forward and go backwards and forwards and just diagnose what happens. You can debug from the point of failure backwards rather than trying to catch it going forwards. And to enable this, a key thing is the fact that we have perfect repeatability. And this is based on the fact that we have control over time, we have control over semantics. By building a software simulation of your hardware, we have much better control over the target system. And this lets us actually make sure it repeats perfectly. And here's just one short example. I have a 20-core multi-core target system. I'm running a test application 100 times and measuring its performance. The total number of cycles executed here is about 8,000 billion clock cycles in the target. And the funny thing is, when I run this demo and I run it again, I get the exact same graph both times. This means that over the space of these 8,000 billion clock cycles, the simulation evolves in the exact same way every time on every host. And that's really what repeatability means. I can take an execution scenario and rerun it at any point in time, and I'm absolutely sure it's going to be bit and cycle exact compared to the first run. And part of that, which I already mentioned, is the fact that we have control over time in CEMEX. Every part of the simulation has the same virtual time, and we start and stop all the time in sync. And this means that we can do single-stepping in any part of the code. You can single-step an intra panel. You can single-step a device driver. You can single-step parallel code and kind of see how the threads interact. When you step, everything stands still waiting for you. And this makes debugging, you know, timing sensitive and parallel things so much easier. We already mentioned checkpointing before. So basically what we do in checkpointing is to save the entire target system state to a file and bring it back up later. And the state means the contents of disk, the contents of memory, processor registers, the current time, anything in flight on a network, across multiple machines. I mean, it's the complete target system. And this suddenly means that you can treat your target system as a Word document. And then you can package it up, email it to other people. You know, when you go home for a day, you can just say what you're doing and get back at the same point the next day. So, now I think we have an animation glitch going on here. So let's see what happens. What this means is that you can actually use checkpoints as a bug reporting mechanism. So let's assume we have something like this. We have a developer who creates some piece of software and sends it to a tester. The tester finds a bug and it now becomes a bug reporter. And this bug reporter now needs to tell the developer what's broken with the software. Usually, this means writing a report describing your system setup, the steps you did, and, you know, a lot of detail, which still probably isn't enough for the developer to actually reproduce the issue. But if we're on a virtual platform, we can actually pass back a virtual platform checkpoint to the developer, and this could capture all the software, all the setup, everything I did to actually run the program, which means that the developer now has a perfect replication of the issue and no way to excuse him or herself by, you know, I can't reproduce this, blah, blah, blah. I mean, if they get the checkpoint, they will get the bug reproduced, and you can be sure that they see the same thing. And this is so convenient when it comes to communicating between teams, because this means that a test team located in India can, you know, do test runs, and if they find a fault, they can package up a checkpoint, hand it back to the US, and the developers responsible for that software can pick it up when it comes to work the next day, debug it, and, you know, deploy the fixed software back to India for the next day's testing. So it enables, you know, around-the-clock, around-the-globe development, and it enables perfect communication between different teams about bugs. And some checkpoint-based, let's see, now, okay, we have to go through this slide again. But my guess, we're in sync now. Yay! We're in sync, good. So, let's go through what you can do with checkpoints. First of all, we boot a target system, we load some software, you know, put software on it, configure it, you know, tell some programs to run, and then we do a run, and then it fails, and we're annoyed. This is a pretty typical, you know, embedded systems development cycle. With checkpoints, we can save a checkpoint after the boot is done. And then we can pick that up later and load some other software and do some other run from the same known good state. We can also take a checkpoint after we've loaded and configured the software. And we can farm it out to parallel machines and do multiple test runs in parallel, all starting from the same identical known state, which means we're much happy to compare the results. And we don't have to redo the boot and load every time we're going to do a test run. Just pick up the checkpoint and run it, which really means that we focus our attention on the interesting parts of the system and don't spend, you know, a lot of time just, you know, recreating a running system, which is completely unnecessary. And if you get a failure, you capture a checkpoint some distance into the test run and you pass it back to somebody else for analysis and fixing. So let's go into the demos. But before we do that, we need to describe the demo system we're using. It has four machines inside a single SIMIC simulation. Two of them are PowerPC, two of them are ARM, two of them are servers, two of them are clients. And this is a software system containing client and server software, which we originally developed and tested on PowerPC. And now we've ported it to ARM, and we want to see just how does this work in all combinations of clients and servers. So now we move into the first demo movie, and now I'm gonna quit talking live and let the demo speak for itself, because that's the best way to keep audio and video in sync. So, that was the first demo movie. So what did we see here? Let's just quickly go through how the workflows worked when compared to what we talked about before. So basically, we had a bootloader system and we loaded software on it. We had one checkpoint taken after the boot, which we opened, just kind of show we could do that. And after the load, we took that checkpoint and ran four different tests, a different combination. If they had been longer, it would have been eminent sense to farm these out into some kind of cluster to run them in parallel. But right now, we just ran them, you know, one after the other. And the result of the testing was that PPC client to PPC server, that works. ARM client to PPC server, that worked. PPC client to ARM server resulted in a failure, and ARM to ARM also resulted in a failure. This kind of points the arrow at the ARM server, right? But maybe not. We'll see as we go in and diagnose this error, because there are actually at least two different places this error could be. First of all, it could be that the packets the server consumes are actually broken. They could contain some format error due to the porting of the client. Or maybe all the clients are broken, it just happens that the ARM compiler of the server has this problem. Or something happened when we compiled the server for ARM and some latent issue materialized itself. At least that's my experience in porting software around. Basically, as you move between compilers and between operating systems, even if they're supposed to be the same as in Linux, you never know what happens when you do a port. So let's go into the next movie and see just what happened here. So that's the end of the debug demo. And just quickly, what we've shown here was a system-level debugger in action. We found the bug, and we can note that we really did, you know, debug multiple everything. We used reverse, we traced exceptions and network packets, and we also actually proved that we could take, you know, a failing scenario and hand it to somebody else, in this case, ourselves, at a late point in time. Final note before we go to questions and answers, the target we used here might have been unfamiliar to most people, and that's because this is a synthetic SEMEC Quick Start platform. And the Quick Start platform is a free platform you get with every purchase of SEMEC, and essentially it's designed to provide a real processor core with a real operating system on synthetic hardware. It provides you with something like VxWorks on ARM, or, you know, PowerPC, Linux, Disk, and Ethernet. And that's enough for most user-level application programs, and it's really very handy for, you know, experimentation with the system because it's much more flexible than real hardware, since we have written the BSP to allow things like scaling from one CPU to 128 or using one Ethernet or 16 Ethernet, for example. So what QSP gives you, and which kind of show there is essentially you can take an application binary, move it from the QSP to a real target platform, and it should behave the same. So this crashing server should crash even if I put it on a real, you know, ARM Versatile Express or something like that. So it's basically the same binary as the real thing. And that concludes my presentation demos, and now it's back over to Jim for QA management.
All righty, thanks. I think that's my cue. Thanks very much, Jakob, for a good presentation, and thanks for our audience for all the good questions that have been coming in. We've got so many good questions, in fact, that I think we're probably going to run out of time. I'm going to run about 5 minutes late here, so about another 10 minutes. Hang in there with us if you'd like to. We'd love to have you along. And for those of you who have to drop off at the hour, again, remember that the presentation will be archived and you'll be able to get all of this later. So let's jump right in here. Does Simix work on any distribution, including homegrown distros of Linux, or are there only specific versions that I can run?
Pretty much everything we've tried it on. I mean, we have a certain set of, you know, supported distros, but in practice, Simix has proven itself to run on, I think, pretty much any Linux we ever tried, provided, you know, we have the right libraries in place, etc. But we're not tied to any particular distro, no.
Okay. And how about VxWorks?
It wouldn't run on VxWorks, but it certainly runs VxWorks on the target.
Right. Okay. Got it. All right. Let's see. Can you tweak a checkpoint in between runs? So, for example, you know, let's say interrupt A happens right after interrupt B instead of before it. If things like that happen, can I mess with the checkpoints?
Actually, you wouldn't do that by messing with the checkpoint, because a checkpoint is a snapshot of the state at a certain point in time. So essentially, the checkpoint is standing still. It's just, you know, one instance. So it doesn't have any concept before or after. But what you can do with Simix, and which we have people actually doing, is to start with that checkpoint and then execute forward on the script control and actually trigger interrupts at different points in time. So you do have the ability to fire, essentially you can imagine, you know, changing the time value of a timer from the outside, or just having a script that just brutally fires off an interrupt at a CPU to see what happens for different ordering. And that has been used for systematic behavior exploration for things like operating systems and device drivers and parallel applications.
Okay. At one point in the presentation, earlier on, you had talked about completely repeatable timing, but that's not necessarily what I've got or even what I want. Sometimes the more interesting problems involve asynchronous systems where the timing's not consistent. How well does Simix handle that?
There's a very good reason why I said repeatable and not deterministic, and that's that if you think about it, as Simix is executing some particular simulation forward, that simulation will follow, you know, some particular timing sequence, so to speak. But if you do things like run the same program several times in a row within the simulation instance, that will see different behaviors each time, because the initial condition for every run will be different due to the fact that time has passed, different time of keystrokes and the accumulated state buildup in the system. Also, if you want particular timing variations, just like we talked with the intro just before, you can actually script that. And we have people actually scripting variation into the system. But the key is that if you script variation into the system, that variation can be repeated. So if you find a bug, thanks to some induced variation, you can repeat that bug. What you don't want is a system that's completely random, and every time you run it, you get different behaviors. Because if you had that, you wouldn't be able to repeat a bug. You wouldn't be able to use checkpoints to do bug transportation. And we couldn't actually implement reverse execution. So the key is that we have repeatability, but we have repeatability of infinitely variable and unpredictable system behaviors.
So it's repeatable but not deterministic. That's a good point. There's a big difference between those two. And even if I have seemingly random bugs or seemingly random timing, I do want it to be repeatable so that I can drill down into it. And as you say, do reverse execution too.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's basically variable but repeatable is how I tend to say it. Because if you look closely at the definition, it has to be deterministic, the core implementation of SIMX to actually enable repeatability. They have a blog post which actually links to a slide that goes through all of these different concepts, because it is a bit complicated to understand, what's changeable, what's not changeable, and where do you induce variations and where do you get the same behaviors as all before out. I mean, it's not entirely trivial.
No, it's certainly non-trivial. We talked earlier about different operating system support. How about different processor architectures? Specifically, does SIMX run on x86?
SIMX runs, today we only run SIMX on x86, 32 and 64-bit Windows and Linux hosts. It used to run on UltraSpark way back in the day, but we actually dropped Spark Solaris as a host system a couple of versions ago because there were no users left on that. If you look at the target system support, and remember, for me, host is what I run on. That's my laptop, my workstation, my server, my cluster. The target is what we're actually simulating. And on the target side, we have much, much broader support. We do support x86, x86, 64, including, the pretty much latest Intel processors like Sandy Bridge, and several Atoms are available in SIMX. We have ARM. We have, Power Architecture, 32 and 64-bit MIPS, 32 and 64. And things like SH, Texas Instruments, DSPs, H8, 8051, old Intels like 8186, pretty much every power PC processor produced after 1990 or something. What else is there? Yeah, we have a few more. I can't just read them all off off the top of my head. So
it's quite a bit.
And we support about 100 different target hardware boards and varieties available as well.
It's a
broad library.
I'll trip you up with one of them here. How about the VxWorks 653?
That's an operating system.
Oh, okay. You're right.
And we have that running on top of SIMX for, I think it's 8548 and some other PowerPC variants. So yes, we can run any operating system on SIMX, including pretty much every variety of VxWorks, Wind River Linux, other Linuxes, We have seen Windows, and we have seen Unix, and pretty much, take a pick of an RTOS or Server OS. Somebody at some point has run that on some SIMX model.
Given all those various different platforms and all those permutations, I think this is going to be a pretty open-ended question. But anytime I think of simulation or I hear about simulation, I think, oh no, this is going to be really, really slow. Can you give us any kind of idea of what the performance difference is between simulation and real-life hardware? And I realize that's a pretty broad question, but if you can put some boundaries on it.
It's one of the most common questions we get. And our favorite answer is, it depends, but it was just, perfectly true and perfectly useless. But in practice, what we tend to see is that if you look at things like peak simulation speed, we can get to a few thousand million target instructions per second from a single CPU. So we're talking about a GIPS-level simulator here. And that lets us, on average, with various tricks and optimizations, keep up typically we try to stay within about a factor of 10 of a real system, but the kind of threshold where it's useful completely depends on what you're doing, the size of the system. For some people, you have to be actually run at real time because we're using this to control mechanical systems, and that has been done, it's being done. For other people, a slowdown of 100 is perfectly fine because they have to do very, very large runs overnight and they have no real alternative. But I would say that the ballpark we're trying to get it to be useful is within a factor of 5 to 10.
Oh, that's actually pretty reasonable. I'd be very happy with that. Speaking of speed, I'm still trying to wrap my head around how I would simulate and debug a real-time system. Oftentimes, you know, my system under test is connected to real live hardware that's going to send input or interrupts. One of our readers gives the example of ARINC 429 communications where there's a lot of external real-time activity. How is that handled?
It kind of depends on, remember, we said full system here, right? So most of our customers work with these systems actually take the SEMIC simulation of the digital component of the system, and then we simulate ARINC 429 or MIL standard 1553 or Ethernet or serial communications from the digital system to the surrounding world, like remote terminals, other boards. So we kind of try to swallow as much as possible of the system, including very often mechanical system models. So SEMIC talks to other simulators to kind of do actuation sensor interactions. Or we can actually just patch out to the real world. And in that case, you pass the messages through, but you kind of let the hardware handle the timing so things don't time out. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, different ways you could do that. But in practice, the best solution tends to be to build a completely virtual solution where you also virtualize or simulate at least part of the mechanical system you're working with.
Okay, got it. I think there's a lot more we could drill into here, almost enough for a whole another e-cast. Maybe we'll look at that for another day. But we're going to have to wrap up today's presentation. I'd like to thank our audience members, certainly, for all the great questions you've had and all the great ones that are still pending, and for your attention throughout our presentation. Certainly, a big thanks to Jakob Engblom from Wind River Systems, who's filled in a whole lot of the details on SIMICs and simulated debugging. This has been the Open Systems Media eCast on resolving bugs in hours, minutes, instead of weeks, months, and years. As always, this will be archived and online pretty quickly, so you can download it using the URL we're going to pop up on your screen. And we're also on iTunes. In fact, if you just search for Embedded eCast on iTunes, you'll find not only today's eCast, but all the other ones we've done previously. So thanks again for everybody's attention. I'm Jim Turley. Hope you're having a great day. Talk to you soon. Bye.